Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back. This is John Vecchione again for Administrative Static, and Mark and I are here, and we kind of had a fun discussion because it involved Katie Couric, and this one's going to be a little less fun because we have to report that NCLA lost a preliminary injunction motion that had been made in the case of Norris versus Stanley, which is a case against Michigan State University's basically saying they're using the CDC standards to impose a vaccine mandate on people, their employees, even when their employees have had COVID and have higher antibody tests than people who get vaccinated and have all the markers of protection that are greater than what MSU allows other people. And so I just want to describe certain facts here because I don't want, this is not like vaccines don't work or we don't like vaccines or something, but basically this is almost a ping pong of wrong administrative power. First the CDC says things, then MSU says it's bound or it follows those things, and they point fingers at each other, and they do it in such a way, but MSU does not really follow everything CDC says, and it allows people from foreign countries with vaccines that are I won't say worthless, but very unreliable vaccines as opposed to the ones we have in America. And they say, oh, that's fine. You've been vaccinated. So getting a shot, regardless of its real world protections, is all they make you do. And yet they make you do it even when you've already had the disease and you have higher protections than any of those shots. So there's an arbitrary and capricious nature of this, and it is completely unsoundly based. But the court listened to our arguments and ruled last week, I think on the 8th, on October 8th. And there's some very disturbing things in this opinion that I want to talk about. It's not going to be the end of the story. This is preliminary injunction, and there's going to be a lot more legal proceedings. But I do think that we've discussed preliminary injunctions before and the high standard, so we're not going to discuss that today. But I do want to discuss what's unusual or disturbing, and I think should be disturbing in this case. One of the prongs was whether what right was being addressed and whether strict scrutiny should be applied because there is a very important constitutional right. And what the court said was, although plaintiff advocates that strict scrutiny should apply because MSU's vaccine policy violates her fundamental right to privacy and bodily integrity under the 14th Amendment, this argument is without merit. Plaintiff is absolutely correct that she possesses those rights, but there's no fundamental right to decline a vaccination. And then he cites a district court case that contraception, abortion, and vaccination all involve bodily autonomy, yet bodily autonomy has not been deemed a fundamental right. Now, I have to disagree with that quite a bit, because really, even your Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment seizure cases, they're looked at, if the police touch you when they shouldn't touch you, that's a battery.
That's right. And if they can't do a blood draw without consent in most circumstances, for example.
Right. And so there's all kinds of things. I mean, this is kind of this is kind of nuts that the state can do what they want to your body regardless of their reason, because this, he combines that, the fact that there's no right to bodily integrity, that he also says that there's no she has no protected interest in her job, which he may be right about that, but it is a little unjust that you can be fired for retaining your constitutional rights in other areas. But nonetheless, it says she just can't work at MSU. Now, keep in mind, this same court has found that there's a religious exemption. So you can be unvaccinated, not have any antibodies, and your religious exemption is okay. And that's been affirmed by the Sixth Circuit. And I don't quarrel with that, but I do quarrel with the fact that he then applies a rational basis test to this forcing you to have an injection. Well, what else can they force you to do? Can they force you to undergo liposuction? Let's say I'm overweight and it has all these horrible consequences, as it does. Can MSU say that as a health standard, we don't want people having heart attacks and falling down around us, and we really believe that you should have to have liposuction and force all of their, let's say your BMI is over 28, then they can force you to have liposuction? Well, that sounds ridiculous to everybody, but okay, you don't have a right to body integrity, and all they have to come up with is a rational basis test. Now, every lawyer will tell you, until a few years ago, rational basis test meant absolutely nothing, and now it just seems to mean something in same-sex marriage cases. But other than that, the rational basis test is extremely low bar, really low. And so what he says is you have no right to bodily integrity, and then if the state can come up with any reasonable argument, they win. So how am I wrong, Mark, that liposuction can be forced on extremely overweight people?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And you know, if you look at the Supreme Court sort of trend on this, back in 2013, the court had said that a non-consensual blood draw without a warrant in a routine DUI case violated the Constitution. That was a 5-4 decision. But what I had forgotten it was that there's a subsequent case in which the court upheld a Wisconsin law that says that people driving on a public road have impliedly consented to having their blood drawn. But you're just talking about, there's nothing about being an employee of a state university that suggests that you've impliedly consented to having anything put in your body. So I don't think that the case is a perfect analogy in that regard.
Well, then he goes on, and I know this is near and dear to you. He says, he talks about Jacobson v. Massachusetts, 1905. Plaintiff attempted to distinguish her case from Jacobson v. Massachusetts, but was unsuccessful. She argues that her case is different because Jacobson never considered natural immunity and because the policy in Jacobson was subject to bicameralism and presentment to the Massachusetts legislature, which you think would be a big deal.
Yeah, you would think.
The state of Massachusetts actually considered this with aforethought, used its massive power to say that if you didn't get the smallpox vaccine, they would fine you, you know, $20,
$5,
$140 now. So the point of it being is that did the legislature do? It considered it, and it considered a very, very dread disease. And it made this law after consideration. And then the penalty is not losing your job and your livelihood. The penalty is a fine because what they were trying to do is get people to get the vaccine, but they didn't think even then that it was so bad that you should be basically thrown out of society.
Right.
And of course, MSU doesn't have to do any of that. They don't have to weigh and balance any of that stuff under this analysis. And then it says, first, the asserted factual difference between Jacobson and plaintiff's case are not relevant. Over the last year and a half, courts have looked at Jacobson to infer that a rational basis standard applies to generally applicable vaccine mandates. Facts of the case are obviously not going to be identical to every COVID vaccine case that has been or is currently being litigated. And he quotes a bunch of them. This court must apply the law from the Supreme Court. Jacobson essentially applied rational basis review and found the vaccine mandate was rational, protecting the public health and safety. Now, there's a lot of work being done by essentially in that sentence. Because neither Mark or I believes that Jacobson really was a rational basis analysis, the way that came to be after Caroline Products in the 30s and 40s, what the court meant by that. It's just not. So,
The idea that the rational basis standard should apply to challenges to your bodily integrity, that's where I'm having a problem. Rational basis, regardless of whether you think it should apply to things like economic regulation, the idea that the government can forcibly put something in your body and that you don't have a constitutional right to prevent that, as long as they have a so-called rational basis, that's obscene. I mean, that's the most fundamental kind of right that you have. And so for that to be taken away from you, for the government to be able to force medicate you, that's a real problem.
I have another
one. That way lies tyranny.
I have another example. What if there was a lice outbreak and the MSU said that in order to work here, everyone has to shave their heads, women, men, everyone. We aren't going to allow anybody to have hair on their heads. And they then said, listen, this takes away a lot of man hours, having to go get the medicine. Well, you could say, well, there's a cure for it, right? We'll just get the medicine. And they say, no, we think that if you don't have any hair at all, the lice won't stay there. And it's much more effective than all these lice medications you have when your kids come home from school with lice, right?
RID, I think, is the big one.
Right, exactly. So, and we bring a case so that we say, listen, the administrative agency doesn't have the power to do that. And look, there's more protection in RID, or it's at least as good as shaving your head. And the courts under this standard have got to say, if everything lines up, they have to say, well, it's just your hair. You don't have a right to bodily integrity. I mean, your hair falls out, right? It's not even the shot. And then everyone in the place has to have their head shaved.
Unless you're a Sikh, because they are still, this judge believes in religious exemptions. He just doesn't believe in anything else.
Right. And so the Sikhs have very long that hair they put in their turban. They don't cut their hair. Exactly.
That's right. That's right.
So that's a good one. That's exactly right. So, it's just absolutely, it's absolutely amazing when you apply it in other contexts. Now, we will see what happens. We're going to keep going with this case, but if you don't want to be forcibly liposucked or head shaved, you should follow this.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. I wanted to talk about a book review that I read this week in the Wall Street Journal. The piece appeared, I believe, in the print edition on October 13th. And it's a book review of a book by Jonathan Rauch of the Brookings Institution. And the name of the book is The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth. And I have not read the book. But I did read this book review, and it has a very interesting point of view that I think is worth sharing with our audience, Vec. And it talks about something that we've talked a lot about, at least internally. I don't know how much we've talked about it on the radio show or the podcast, but this idea that experts are controlling America, and particularly this expertise, the sort of fetishization of expertise in the administrative state, is part of the problem. I mean, you were just talking about this in the Norris case, the fact that the CDC makes some recommendation and then Michigan State University follows that recommendation, that's enough for a judge to violate your constitutional rights. Well, what if those experts are wrong? What if they did sloppy work? What if they have an agenda other than truth or what have you? Those considerations seem to get put to the side. But what this review is talking about, and again, the book has a slightly different focus than the review of the book has, but because the book itself is a defense of experts and expertise, and there's an interesting phrase used. The author of the book defends the ruling class as a "quote unquote reality-based community," and I think that's interesting terminology, because that's the kind of worldview that the experts would want us to have, right? They want us to think that the experts are just looking at the facts and looking at the empirical sort of tests and these kinds of things, and that they're not led astray by other kinds of considerations. And look, some of those other kinds of considerations that lead people astray, and the article talks about this, the fact that the internet and all the clickbait is not driven by the search for truth, but is driven by trying to sometimes distract people from the truth or to burden their sort of thinking processes with a bunch of information that makes it a bunch of false information that makes it difficult to sort of process and sort the truth and the reality from all of the disinformation that's out there on the internet. So the metrics and algorithms and whatnot care about popularity, but they're indifferent to truth, the article says. So that's one of the things that can disorient people and so forth. But as the author points out, these experts often are blinded to other things that the rest of us are not blinded to. So, and he refers to the quote profound longings of human beings, and is referring to things like religious conviction and the value of things like love and some of these other things that the cold numbers and the calculated empiricism of the experts don't always take into consideration. So they might think that a months on end lockdown makes sense, and they're not stopping to consider the effect that has on ordinary people. And the fact that they may be able to withstand something like that in their mansions or, you know, and by the way, they may not even follow these rules that they lay down for the rest of us, but they don't stop and think about the effect this has on someone who lives in a one-room apartment and has to endure lockdown like a prison over that, you know, same kind of time period. But but I think that this and again, this was in the Wall Street Journal, and it was on October 13th. So I recommend it to you. The Constitution of Knowledge is the name of the book, and the Mark, but I particularly recommend the review to you. Go ahead, Vic.
In Roger's defense, I'm kind of familiar with his writing, and I think he would criticize CDC for not following science, for not having any basis for mass mandates for kids, for instance. Like he one of the things it even says in this review is that what you have to do is have whatever proposition CDC or any of these experts make, it has to be fallible, meaning that if I do the experiment and you do the experiment, we both get the same result, you know? And so I think that what this author of the review is pointing out is that he does have a high confidence in certain kinds of elites. But Michael Barone, also of AEI, the rival to Brookings, or they would say Brookings is our rival, but in any event, they do think that the elites have had enormous power. Barone writes about this all the time, from basically the 30s to the 80s, because the things they touched actually worked. We sent a man to the moon. We won World War II. We made nuclear power. All that stuff was done by that set of elites. And people saw that the things worked, and then somehow they just stopped working. And I would argue that they stopped working because they became ideologically uniform, and that they make propositions that aren't fallible, that you can't test by science. And if you test them by science and come out the wrong way, you get fired or thrown out.
That's right. And I think you're right. And I just want to make a quick distinction between which the article makes between fallibilism and empiricism. So fallibilism is the fact that something can be debunked, right? If it withstands attempts to debunk it, then we tend to think that it's true. Empirical is the method that's used to check something, right? So if we get the same result regardless of whether you run the experiment or I run the experiment, then that's an empirical result. It doesn't depend on anyone's opinion and so forth. But one of the things that he goes on to talk about here is the problem with cancel culture And he talks about this as being a challenge from the inside of the sort of expert community. And Mr. Rausch apparently in the book calls this a kind of emotional safetyism. And it treats arguments that rather than as disagreements, it treats them as threats that have to be policed. And it turns a culture of critical review into a culture of confirmation bias and censorship. And boy, are we seeing that in spades in the vaccine debates, where any sort of suggestion that the CDC might be wrong, or that it's discounting the value of natural immunity and so forth, is just very, very different. I mean, not only is that getting shot down by government folks, but some of these things are getting shot down by big tech as well, right? So the debate is just, the allowed ground of debate is shrinking all the time. And that is not a recipe for truth finding when that kind of thing is going on. And the idea that certain folks are on the outside and that their ideas are you know, not going to be allowed in the debate, even if these folks are, you know, people who, you know, a year ago would have been thought as part of the knowledge culture, right? I mean, you have professors at Harvard and Stanford and Johns Hopkins and so forth who are being threatened with termination because they are espousing views that differ from the received wisdom of the majority or the received wisdom of the government funded scientists anyway. And that's a disturbing trend that we see. And I think to get back to the article, I think it undercuts the authority of the knowledge class. When other people see that kind of thing happening and they see that the answers that the government comes up with are in many places illogical. So even if they survive a rational basis review by a judge, they don't survive the rational basis review by the American public, who recognizes that, look, if my kid has had chicken pox, then they don't need the chicken pox vaccine before they go to kindergarten. That's the whole point.
And Mark, and
they understand that sort of common sense worldview.
The other thing is, the world is, you know, it's not just America. You look at other places and they do different things and they have better or worse outcomes. So it's not like CDC or any of these elites can chop you off from all that knowledge. You can see that whether mask mandates are having an effect or whether vaccine mandates or, you know, you can actually see the different results because there have been different policies. And we look at Australia or someplace like New Zealand, they can really cut off their borders in ways that nobody else can, and they're still unable to eliminate the virus that way. I mean, that should be powerful information, but it doesn't seem to come across. But we'll see what happens. But I do, I always have read Rausch with even when I disagree with him, which is frequently. I do think that he presents very good arguments. And I think that what he's doing, I think, is that since the elites are falling out of such of reverence, he still thinks we need elites to do certain things. And so this is sort of like a defense. And I don't think he should be thrown in the camp of a guy who thinks that people with college degrees or PhDs should always be listened to. I don't think that's what he's saying.
No, but he says the constitution of knowledge, a defense of truth. It does sound like more like a defense of elites than it is a defense of truth, because the idea, and again, this is where the review departs from the article, the idea that the elites or that the bureaucrats have all the answers is just wrong. And I think you see this with the lockdowns, where the average person in a time of crisis sees the value in religion, sees the value of turning to church, sees the value of continuing to gather with other people in prayer and so forth to push back the evil tide of something like the pandemic. Whereas the atheist or agnostic government bureaucrat doesn't take that into calculation at all, or to the extent they do, only they try to decide whether or not this particular rule that they want to pass will survive the Supreme Court's First Amendment review. But they don't take things like religion into account when they force these policies down the throats of the rest of us. And that's a real problem, and it undercuts the authority of the expert class, as well it should.